Hi everyone, I'm Kyle Dyer and welcome to Colorado Inside Out on this Friday, March the 29th. It is the last show of Women's History Month, so our panel reflects that this week. So let me welcome Patty Calhoun, founder and editor of Westword, Krista Kafer, columnist with the Denver Post, Elena Alvarez, reporter at Axios Denver, and Amber McReynolds, National Election Administration expert, former director of elections for the City and County of Denver, and I should also mention co-author of When Women Vote. The only thing our Colorado legislature is mandated by the state constitution to do every year is come up with a balanced budget. And on Tuesday, lawmakers revealed their $40.6 billion budget, $2 billion more than last year. And this is all to keep the government running next year. But Patty, some of that money is already allotted for, and then there's a whole bunch that other people want to use, and we just don't have money for everything.
Well, the majority is already allotted, but let's give kudos at least to the legislature, which, unlike Congress, does have to come up with a balanced budget. So there was one problem, it's $170 million shortfall they discovered earlier this year from the projections. So a lot of the wish list that people had has disappeared. But you only have a pittance, $16 billion in the general fund where you can have a little play. And what we're looking at this year right now in the proposal is workforce development, putting more money to corrections, and especially putting money to education. That this is the first time they've really balanced that and paid the amount in that they are supposed to. We talked about that at the start of the session, that that's a real accomplishment. Money going to K through 12, a little more to higher ed, more to preschool, and then you also have funding for the immigrants' children who are here. So it's a really tough thing to balance. We know they're going to be throwing things in and out over the next, 2.5 weeks? But in the meantime, they've gotten started, and no one has been hauled screaming from the chambers yet.
Not yet, and it could happen, right? Theatrics are all part of the legislative process, and I want to echo what Patty had to say in that it's great that they've finally fully funded education as they've been told to do, basically. I appreciate that. I also appreciate that they've put aside some money to, say, additional funds to help those who are languishing in jail with mental health issues and need to get help so that they can stand trial. Right now they can't stand trial because they're not mentally competent, but there's nowhere for them to go and they're languishing in jail, and that is not where we need to have people who have mental illness issues. I have to say, I don't particularly appreciate, speaking of jail, that there's, $5 million for sex change operations and hormone pills for men in prison who would like to be women. As a taxpayer, I'm feeling a little resentful. But finally, I would have liked for that body to consider homeowners, like much of us here at the table, that we have to pay really high property taxes this year, and a little help in our direction would have been appreciated.
So this budget process is unique for a couple of reasons. As Patty mentioned, there's that $170 million shortfall. Now, lawmakers only found out about that a few weeks ago, and they had been drafting this budget since November. So it sent them scrambling to essentially scrape up any pennies they could find to try and fund at least partially their priorities. The second reason why it's unique is because it's also the last of the federal pandemic-related relief dollars. So next year's budget will be a little bit tighter on top of the shortfall that they're already trying to scramble around. One thing to double down on, we've talked about education, there's also a lot of money for housing, but is really bolstering Colorado's state workforce, which is plagued with worker shortages. That affects everything from public defenders to healthcare professionals. And so they're doing so by offering raises, they're offering signing bonuses, and really just creating more money to hire more people. That's expected to help, but as one lawmaker that was quoted in the Colorado Sun recently put it, it's a Band-Aid on a, how does she put it, on a sucking chest wound. So it's much more money is needed to really to fix this issue.
Mm-hmm. Amber.
Yeah, and I want to echo everything that's been said so far. I think the commitment to education is critically important, obviously, and then affordability. I mean, the that housing crisis, not only in the metro area, but in the rural areas, mountain communities, it affects the workforce broadly, and especially, you know, frontline workers, nurses, postal employees cannot afford to live in the communities that they're in, and therefore a lot of vacant jobs. And so when people see mail delivery issues, a lot of that is because we're actually understaffed because people aren't applying for the jobs because they can't afford to live there. So addressing affordability, I think, is just critical.
Mm-hmm. So first the House takes it, then it goes to the Senate, then there's a conference committee before that can be finalized. So we'll be talking about this for the next several weeks. Women's rights are getting a lot of attention these days, be it women's rights to defend themselves or women's reproductive rights. There are discussions happening in the Supreme Court and within the Colorado legislature, Krista.
You know, I appreciate that I have a right to defend myself. I don't know that I need a bump stock to do that. So I think putting parameters around what we can use to defend ourselves is a job of the legislature. I think they may end up erring a bit on the side of too much control, but I can understand why they're grappling with this issue. Speaking of grappling at the Supreme Court, we saw justices questioning plaintiffs and litigants in this court case involving abortion pills. And it was brought by physicians who said, we have deep concerns about women's health. It used to be that for abortion pills, a doctor actually had to see a patient. Why is that important? 1 in 25 women will end up in the emergency room because of complications with chemical abortions or abortion pills. And so having those safeguards in place was really important for women's health. Also really important in diagnosing an ectopic pregnancy, which is when the baby has attached inside the fallopian tube, if that is not treated, it is fatal for both baby and mom. Unfortunately, if you have taken abortion pills, it will not address that issue. And so there are women who have pain because of the abortion pills or bleeding, and they sort of chalk it up to the pills when in fact it's this pregnancy, and the pregnancy is fatal, again, for both parties unless it's addressed. So these physicians came forward and said, we really need to have the court look at the FDA's decision to take away these safeguards. This is not about eliminating access to the pill. It's not going to make abortion pills illegal. You'll still be able to access them. It's just that it's going to require the FDA to consider women's health to make sure that women who take these pills, we already know a child is lost, but we don't want loss of additional life. We don't want women in the emergency room. We don't want women having serious complications that could end in the loss of being able to bear children in the future, or even in unusual cases, death. So I commend these doctors. We'll see what happens. I can understand their concern that, do we want the court questioning the FDA? Perhaps that should be Congress's. That should be a part of Congress. Maybe it's something that voters decide when they choose who they're going to put into the executive, who's going to end up putting the head of the FDA. There are other safeguards that might be better. I understand that. But I do feel that the FDA has erred with regard to women's health, and I hope that there's at least some addressing of that for all of our sake.
And the Supreme Court's not expected to make a decision until June on that.
No, it's going to be a tough decision.
Yeah. Okay. Elena.
Yeah, so certainly all eyes are on the Supreme Court right now. It does seem, as it stands right now, that it could be unlikely to ban access to the abortion pill because you have multiple conservative justices raising issues with different parts of the case. Of course, anything could happen. But I think as it stands right now, as you're seeing the arguments unfold, women healthcare providers in Colorado are breathing a sigh of relief a bit because they know that a ban on the pill would mean a spike in access to care on top of the surge in out-of-state patients that we've seen in Colorado post-Roe's reversal. The most recent data that I've seen is that the demand for abortions in Colorado between 2020 and 2023 has surged 83%, and the system is really struggling to keep up. So it goes back to my previous point about how important it is to really address the labor shortages and get people into healthcare. You know, the demand is not going anywhere, especially as Colorado takes steps to further protect abortion access. We have a measure coming on this November ballot that would guarantee constitutional access to abortion rights. So as those safeguards continue to be put in place, that demand is going to keep growing.
Amber.
Well, I think all of these issues continue to highlight the importance of representation. And women are 51% of the population, and they are nowhere near that in terms of representation at the federal level and in most states. Frankly, the United States is 75th in the world in women's representation. Colorado is one of a few states, only three, I think, that have never elected a woman governor or Senate. In the United States Senate, there are actually more men named John than there are Republican women right now in the Senate. So these, you know, issues continue to be decided by not women. So I think that all of these issues and all of these discussions, no matter how you vote, it's really important that women are fairly represented, and we are currently not seeing that at most levels of government right now in the United States and in Colorado, having a few gaps when it comes to this.
Okay.
Well, let's bring it back to Colorado, which is, this is the first state to legalize abortion, limited abortion certainly, and it was Dick Lamb who pushed it through in 1967, and you see the rights that have come since then. The Supreme Court is obviously not the only arena where we are having this discussion. You look at all the states that are beginning to, you look at what's happened in Texas and in other states where people are being prohibited the right to have an abortion. That's why, as Elena said, the demand in Colorado is not because everyone in Colorado is having unprotected sex. The demand in Colorado is because people are coming from other states, like Texas, where they cannot get a very basic health care right. This, in many cases, you have women who would be in the emergency room because the pregnancy is dangerous, who are not allowed to end the pregnancy in their own state. So we have got to make sure that people have access, and that's going to be part of voting in November. It's going to be a huge issue.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's talk about elections now. And Elena, this week, Axios Denver wrote about how Colorado is leading the way when it comes to the number of women holding municipal offices.
That's right. So the report from the Center for American Women in Politics at Rutgers found that women make up 46% of municipal office holders in Colorado. Again, that's not, to Amber's point, you know, it could be a lot better, but we're leading the country. And you really don't have to look far to see how evident that is at the local and state level. You look at the Colorado House of Representatives, all three executive leadership positions are filled by women. Denver City Council has a female majority and a record number of Latinas at that. Another example is actually the city of Federal Heights, just north of Denver, which made history in 2022 when it elected an all-female city council, made state history, I should clarify. And that leadership dynamic is still in place. Also, to Amber's point, you know, it is interesting, surprising that Colorado's never had a female governor. It's also surprising that Denver has never had a female mayor. Of course, Kelly Bruff came close last year. She made it to the runoff election. But even after campaigning on that ticket, you know, to really break the glass ceiling, she still lost to a man. So it'll be really interesting to see when and who causes Denver voters to decide, you know, the time has finally come to flip the script.
Who, right? Mm-hmm. Amber.
Yeah, well, I was excited to see that report. Obviously, Colorado leading on local offices. And a lot of that is there's also the vast majority of county clerks are women. And so they fall in that kind of local category. And certainly our legislature has a really high percentage. We're very highly ranked on that. But we get a C for women's representation, partly because of our federal level, and then also the mayor of Denver, and you know, those have not elected a woman before. And so, you know, one of the other pieces that I found interesting about the Rutgers report is the top three states are all also mail ballot states. So Nevada, Oregon, and Colorado are all in that top three. That means that when you provide more voting access, which is what I wrote in my book, basically, that, you know, you will see more fairly representative issues. And all the bottom states in that report have highly restrictive voting policies. You have to have an excuse to get vote by mail. They have very restrictive voter registration deadlines. So there's consistencies when we think about policies, voting access laws, all those things that definitely impact the outcomes that we see in some of these reports.
Interesting.
Well, it's really great to see the number of women who are in powers of position in municipalities and really dictating how we're living in Colorado day to day, or I should say working with people on how we live in Colorado day to day. The failure to elect a female governor or mayor of Denver or senator always seems to be a matter of timing in some ways. I mean, if Kelly Brough hadn't been one of 17 candidates, it might have shifted a little bit. I think if she had run against Michael Hancock in his third term, she would have won. So I think part of it is a matter of timing. I would hope it is certainly not a matter of Colorado voters not being willing to vote for a woman in the ultimate position of power, because clearly there are women in very important positions throughout this state, and they are the ones who are getting a lot of the things done in Colorado.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to push back. Being a woman does not necessarily mean that you're good in that position. I'm thinking about Lauren Boebert right now. I'm thinking about Elizabeth Epps. So Boebert, obviously, in the U.S. House of Representatives, Epps in the General Assembly, both who have been embarrassing to their respective parties. What I want to see is men or women, and I really don't care which one, as long as they've got character, as long as they're thoughtful, Democrat or Republican, they actually think through issues, they actually look at costs and benefits, they actually do their job and spend more time doing their job than political theater. I want to see people who are of substance. And certainly we have women that in the state have had women in positions of power, women of substance. But sometimes I see women who are in office that really shouldn't be there. And so I would say there are other criteria besides a double X chromosome to take the seat at the table.
Okay. All right. At this table, we have two women who, for different reasons, have spoken locally, nationally, internationally about elections, Amber and Krista, and it hasn't always been easy, but it's something that you believe in. I'm curious, are there certain women that you two or all of us really look at as someone being a standout in our community who really made a lasting impact, or either historically or someone present day? Let's start with you, Amber.
Okay. Well, I'm going to give a historical and I'm going to give a present day.
Okay.
So after Colorado passed suffrage on the ballot and was the first state to do so, in 1894, there were three women elected and then were sworn in 1895 to the legislature, Clara Cressingham, Carrie Holly, and Frances Clock. They were the first women to be elected in Colorado. So I think that's historically significant. They jumped in, raised their hand, wanted to serve, and became the first women after women could actually vote, so in the very first election cycle as well. And then more recently, and I was part of this group. So there was an incredible group of women that came together at the end of 2012, early 2013, to design, create the legislation that became Week 1303 in 2013. That it was House Bill 1303 that provided for this new modernized Colorado voting model. So proactively mailing ballots, proactive voter registration, better list maintenance, things like ballot tracking, modernized vote centers. That was the first time that had ever been done in the country. Ballot tracking was the first done here. And so I'm going to name just a few of them that were part of this, but Tiffany, Sheila, Pam, Hillary, Martha, Elena, Dickie Lee Hollinghorse was the speaker at the time. So just honestly, it was all bipartisan. All those women are different parties. They took a lot of heat from, especially on the Republican side, from their own party for doing what they were doing. And I just can't say enough about the group that came together to do that, because it made Colorado one of the top states to vote in. And it's paved the way for all kinds of other positive reforms that have happened here.
Okay.
Well, I went back to the early days. We used to do the history, the time machine here, and it was always fun to research different people in Colorado. One person, if you've never heard of her, you should go look her up immediately. Clara Brown. She was born into slavery. She was finally freed in the 50s after having 1850s, after having lost all her family, her children. She moved to Colorado, broke, obviously, went to Central City, became a laundress, wound up amassing enough money that she could help other slaves resettle here. She became basically an incredibly successful businesswoman who could not vote because she was a woman, could not vote because she was black, but is a leader. She was the first black member of the Colorado Pioneers. If you haven't ever heard about her, read about Clara Brown.
Okay, thank you. And Time Machine, we should mention, if there are newer viewers, is when you all used to dress up on the show and have, Christy, you were on one of those shows too?
I wasn't, but no. I loved the pictures.
And you played historical characters talking about current day topics.
Right, exactly. And I think some of them, you can still watch them on YouTube.
You can still watch them on YouTube, so check them out. All right, Krista.
So I'm going to give a hats off to two women that have Colorado connections, though neither were born here. So Madeleine Albright, former U.S. Secretary of State, who came here when she was 11, and also Condoleezza Rice held the same position, and her connection to Colorado, actually they were both connected to DU, Denver University, and also Condoleezza Rice now owns a share in the Broncos. Both of these women to me are models of women in power, gracious, super smart, super classy, talented in multiple ways, not just good thinkers, but also just talented Renaissance women. And so I would love to see more women like Condoleezza Rice and Madeleine Albright. And if I was going to have a poster on my wall of awesome women, it would be the two of them.
Okay. All right. Good. Elena.
These are all fantastic picks. I'm going to switch it up just a little bit and mention somebody who just joined Colorado politics scene. So someone I'm watching really closely, her name is Sarah Plastino. She was appointed last month by Mayor Mike Johnston to lead Denver's migrant response. Now, this is a big deal because not only is this a huge role, really critical right now during a crisis, but also because this position was never created before. It's brand new. So she's really forging her own path here. It's obviously too early to give her a grade on how she's doing. She just started. But I'm wishing her the best as she's balancing not only this very big role, but also she's a mother to two little boys. One's 4 years old, one's 6 months old. And I think it's really impressive and admirable to be doing both major, very important jobs.
Absolutely is. All right, thank you. Now let's go down the line and talk about some of the highs and lows of the week. We're going to start on the low point so we can end on a good note, Patty.
Well, I'm hoping Krista didn't think I was suggesting everyone should vote for a woman, whether or not she's competent. I would like to see all politicians be competent. And that takes us over to the RNC, which we are about to have, I would argue, a not very competent person run. And in the meantime, they're asking applicants to be on the staff how they feel about the 2020 election. Was it really fair? Was it really genuine? So that's all we need to suggest election denial as we go into November.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking that if you're going to pay off your legal fees for having slept with a porn star and then paid her off in a, underhanded way, coming afoul of the campaign finance rules, that you probably shouldn't be selling Bibles. Just a thought, my shame of the week. I don't even know if it could get worse, really, although I think it will. But my shame of the week goes to Donald Trump for selling patriotic Bibles, and shame on anyone who would buy one.
This isn't really a disgrace, but it's certainly a dark moment. Okay. In Denver. So this week, a woman was fatally shot at one of the hotels turned homeless shelters that the city is operating. And she is the third person to be fatally shot at this hotel. And according to Denver Gazette's reporting that came out just today, she marks the seventh person since this shelter opened in December that has died there. Some of their causes of death haven't been released, but it's really concerning. I know Mayor Johnston has upped security over there, but there's a problem. And it's really sad to know it's affecting, you know, some of our most vulnerable in the community.
Well, security was upped and then that person was shot and killed.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's bad.
So my low will continue to be the grift about the conspiracies around the election. And I work with election officials not only in Colorado but around the country, and they continue to get harassed all the time about all of this work, and they are simply public servants and they're doing their jobs, and their lives shouldn't be threatened, their families shouldn't be threatened, and it continues to happen because the lies continue to be told about the 2020 election by the same people that have told them for 4 years.
And it's just going to ramp up before November, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. All right, let's talk about something positive, Patty.
I want to say hello to our faithful viewers, the Nitwits.
Yes.
For Women's Month, they watch every week. They comment on what's going on. They're at Holly Creek community. So the Nitwits are most faithful watchers.
And the Nitwits are master knitters. That's
yes.
what the name comes from.
Exactly. Yes. Not as some of the Republican Party might be.
That's fantastic. I want to just dovetail on something that both Amber and Elena said. For one, I think that Denver's doing a beautiful job with migrants. These people are here, they're awaiting adjudication in terms of their asylee claims, and this idea that we can simply push them into another community or pack them on a bus is wrong, it's immoral. And yet Denver has proactively embraced these people, both the government and civilians, to give them shelter and food as they await the ability to work. And then for election workers, the fact that they continue to live under the dark cloud of lies, yet they keep doing their jobs. Thank you, Amber, as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right. Thank you, Amber. It's not every day that I compliment Denver International Airport because it frequently feels like a zoo over there, but new federal data shows that 81% of its flights are departing on time, which is a huge improvement from this time last year when it was around 58% because of snafus with Southwest Airlines. That's still below the national average by about 2 percentage points, but hey, we will take it.
We will, and I haven't, but my husband and my daughter have gone through new security. They say that's pretty easy. You guys done that yet?
Yeah, it's quite
better. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, that's good, that's good. Amber.
Okay, I have two things and props to go with. So. In 2020, the Postal Service put out, in honor of it being 100 years since women, since suffrage passed at the federal level, a stamp. So there is actually a Women Vote Forever stamp. You can order them online. This is from the first day of issuance, and this is actually a first day of issuance postmark. But it was actually issued in Seneca Falls in August 2020. Very few people could go because there was a pandemic. But I would encourage anybody who's interested to buy some of these and use them. They're wonderful. And then the second thing is one of my now new favorite games called Votes for Women. And it is about the suffrage movement. It is a game that, you know, gives all the historical features. It's fun. And you can see on the cover that this really started in the West. And so we should be very proud of our role in, frankly, the start of suffrage in the United States and continuing to see it go across the country.
Excellent. We should mention the way you talk so much about the Postal Service, you are on the Board of Governors.
Yeah.
At the U.S. Postal Service.
Yes.
And tell everyone about next week, too.
Oh, yes. So next week, I'm going to be actually going to California to dedicate the Betty Ford stamp in her honor. It'll be the third in a series of for the First Ladies, and it'll be fun to be there to honor her, who was a women's rights champion. She was one of, the first public figure to talk about her mastectomy and breast cancer. And she obviously started the Betty Ford Clinic, but she also was a champion of the Equal Rights Amendment as well at a time when that wasn't something that, you know, a lot of Republican women were leading on.
And loved in Colorado, so I'm glad you mentioned that for her former neighbors from Beaver Creek and Vail. All right, the thing that makes me happy as we're ending Women's History Month is, I can't believe no one said it, the University of Colorado women's basketball team is playing in the Sweet 16 of the NCAA tournament. It's a game not to miss tomorrow. The CU Buffs are taking on Caitlin Clark and the Iowa Hawkeyes. Coach J.R. Payne's team, she says her team, is underdogs. They've always been underdogs. They like being underdogs. So this is, they're in a happy place. The game starts at 1:30 on ABC, so check it out. And I don't know if you've all heard, but ratings this year have gone up 60% for women's basketball games. So go Buffs. Go women's basketball and go team. Thank you all for joining us this week. We appreciate it. Thank you for watching and or listening to our podcast. I'm Kyle Dyer. I will see you next week here on PBS 12. And for those who celebrate, have a joyous Easter weekend.